to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 231. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
James Jones.
Hello.
And John Lindemann.
What's going on?
We have an exciting show for you, full of new business as usual, lots of games to talk about, and then after the break, we're going to do a listener mail lightning round. And get through as many questions as possible.
What the fuck
is that? Does anyone get that LARPing reference?
No, I do not get it. What is that, from Role Model or something?
Well, no, almost, but it's probably the video that spawned the movie Role Model. It's an old YouTube video of these kids LARPing out in the woods, and one of them is like throwing Nerf darts at his friend saying, "Lightning bolt, lightning bolt."
Yes, I've seen that, okay.
It's fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
It's really old, but yes, we're going to get through as many listener emails as possible.
We're actually going to LARP. We're actually LARPing right now.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
This is your...
I'm not sure what John thinks that means, but...
Radio Free LARPing.
Yep.
But first, we're going to talk about some video games, and James is first up with what I hope and pray will be the next in a long series of patented James Jones rants.
Why did I have to go first?
Oh, God, here we go.
Nobody's going to want to hear this.
You've got a new Wii game that we haven't talked about on the show before.
For good reason.
Ace Combat 8?
No, it's, I wish it were, but no. Instead, we've had Hawks 2 sitting around in the review closet for about 2 months.
This is Tom Clancy's Hawks 2.
Tom Clancy's Hawks 2.
Well, if it's Clancy, you know it's good.
I finally, yeah, fuck you. I finally just fell on the sword and said, just send it to me. I don't care.
He licks every disc before it goes out of the factory.
That would explain a lot. But it showed up this weekend to ruin my weekend, essentially. So basically, you would... I'm gonna open this up, since you all haven't read their review yet. Hawks 2. What do you think this game would be primarily?
I would think it would be a jet fighter game. But it would be extreme, because its name ends with an X.
Which does stand for extreme, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
I think it does.
John is only 50% correct.
Oh, are there... Is this like Star Fox Assault?
Yes, it's exactly like that.
Oh, gosh.
Only about half the missions you actually get to control the fucking jet.
That never goes well.
So, half the missions you control the jet, and that works marginally well. So we'll set those aside for now. But in the other missions, you get to do things like, there's a mode where you're in the jet, so you think, oh, I'm going to fly this jet. But why is the camera under the plane and kind of the plane taking up almost all of the screen?
Can you not change the camera?
No, there's one camera angle.
What?
Yeah, there's one camera. There's no options.
Because isn't the main feature of the original Hawks game was that you could, like, push a button to go into action camera mode or
yeah,
whatever?
Yeah, it doesn't exist anymore.
Because that was, like, the really interesting thing, because in that one it almost felt like... I mean, your camera was way off to the side. It was way far away from the plane, and you had this kind of oblique view on the plane, and you could control it with a joystick. You could make it do all kinds of loops and stuff. Made it look almost like a 2D platformer or something. It was really strange, but it was neat.
That might be in the other versions of the game, but the Wii version of the game is 100% not the same game.
Was this made by Next Level Games?
No. It's, no, I've got another one for you. It's made by Ubisoft. Hungary. Yeah.
Why did we send James Jones a Ubisoft game?
I didn't even know there was an Ubisoft Hungary, and I find that so funny for some reason.
I realized this game was Ubisoft Hungary. I'm like, they have a studio in Hungary? But the really tight camera mode that I was mentioning, you get some maneuvering, but the AI mostly controls the flight path. And likes to smash you into things.
So it's like Halo Reach.
But you die.
Exactly.
That's the difference.
It's like riding shotgun in a warthog.
The problem is, because the plane takes up most of the screen, you can't see where you're going either. So you can't see that the AI is about to plow you into a building. It just happens.
James, can you give us a preview of the score that you gave this?
Oh, I gave it a 4.5.
That's almost average.
It started at 5.5 because I'm like, well, it's really polished. But then I'm like, but it's really polished and bad. So it's a 4.5. It's like if they hadn't polished the crap out of the game appearance, it probably would have dropped into the 4-3-5 range. Hmm. But I thought I was being really hard on the game. So after I finished the review, after it was edited, after I had locked it in, I went to some like aggregator, see what they gave. I'm like, nope, I am right where everybody else was. Okay, I don't feel bad anymore. So there's that garbage mode. There's a garbage mode where it zooms way out like it's a 2D side scroller or top scroller, but it isn't. It's they still expect you to perform acrobatic maneuvers.
So it looks like 1942?
Yes, but you have 360 degrees of motion, and you turn through molasses. So that's not fun. There's a mode in a helicopter that's garbage. But where the game goes apeshit, first off, it's got a story reminiscent of Predator 2. I mean, it's bad.
John, you want to summarize the plot of Predator 2 for
us? Okay, well, the plot of Predator 2 has a predator coming to Earth. I can't even believe I'm summarizing this in this podcast, but a predator comes to Earth, and he is dropped into Los Angeles of 1997.
Good.
Bear in mind, this is a 1990 movie, so 7 years into the future at that time, L.A. has turned into a city that's run...
Sooner than you think.
Sooner than you think. It's run by drug lords who are completely armed to the teeth and are killing cops left, right, and center. They own the city, et cetera, et cetera. Into this is dropped a predator. And at that point, the predator slowly kills off all of Danny Glover's, you know, cop buddies, to which point Glover gets this kind of death wish for the predator, goes after the predator. At the same time, you have, of all people, Gary Busey playing a DEA agent, supposedly, who is actually a government agent, who is also going after the predator to get him for military purposes so we can find out what's going on. So there you go. So you have Predator in LA, drug lords, Danny Glover, Gary Busey, and go.
Here's how I make the connection to Predator 2.
Does Hawks 2 include a cutscene in which your character meets a Rastafarian drug lord in a dark alleyway?
No, it doesn't.
And they have, like, a moment of understanding?
That scene is terrible.
No, but the reason that I feel Predator 2 is related, not topically, but physically, I feel like the storytelling here is Tom Clancy's best. Because... At no point...
Did Tom Clancy ever hear of this game?
I don't think so, but he put his name on it, so it's his fault.
Yeah.
At no point does the game ever explain why you're on a mission. Ever. It just never happens. So there's no connective briefing, there's nothing. You just start the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, someone says, we're going to blow up that building. I'm like, why? I'm like, that's where the enemy is. Okay.
When you're a soldier, that's all that matters.
No,
James.
Because instead we get these, like... 3 or 4 minute hand-drawn stills of people talking about relationships and love blooming on the battlefield bullshit.
Oh, man.
Seriously?
Yes. But but there's, like, 18 instances of betrayal. There's, like, tracking robots and jet fighters. And then, because we needed to get a Bruce Willis moment in here, we get to one of the worst control moments of the game, which is you fly your jet fighter, or actually you fly a helicopter in this particular god-awful mission, to a secret Russian space shuttle installation, hijack their space shuttle, fly the space shuttle through a space minefield.
What?
So that you can hijack their super weapon that can level cities with a laser.
And then you give it to Steve Buscemi?
No, then...
This is like Moonraker.
Yeah, it is actually more like Moonraker than
Armageddon. You use the weapon to destroy this private military contractor's base that he's planning on using to take over the world. You destroy it from space, mind you. At which point, he self-destructs it because turns out he owns the thing. And then you don a special experimental spacesuit, which allows you to halo dive from space to Earth and survive.
That's a real thing. That's in testing now. No shit.
From a space station.
Well, from orbit, yes.
Yeah. This was more like surfing around a bunch of garbage flying in space.
Is Point Break in space? Is that what you're telling me?
Possibly. In Point Break, did you ever, instead of flying a jet plane, control a hawk, as a real hawk, as it flew through rings?
James, you've gone from me wanting to throw up it a little bit inside my mouth as I hear you talk about this game to me actually kind of wanting to play it now.
But it plays terrible. You don't want to play it.
But you get to fly the secret Russian space shuttle up into space, dodging me. Asteroid belts, and then halo dive back to the Earth's surface.
But the best part is you halo dive back to Earth. Oh no, he had another giant mile-wide space station that you didn't notice.
Asteroid M.
What the fuck did he get to? It's so bad. It's awful.
Okay, I'm sorry you had to play this game.
Well, I do have one thing to point out in this game that it felt the world needed. It is a photorealistic top-scrolling shooter that I beat the first level by just holding down the fire button and staying in place. And it took 13 minutes to end the level. It's the slowest top scroller I've ever seen in my life.
You didn't even move the plane at all?
No, I just stood there.
just shot forward for 13 minutes.
I died like twice. That was it. I was like, oh my god. What is this game?
I think you might have been generous with that score, buddy.
I might have been. I might need to change it. It's pretty horrendous. So I'm not falling on the sword for any more review copies.
James is retired from reviews.
Not,
just
I'm
like John
from
and
those
me.
Reviews.
And Greg. No more reviews on
RFN.
I'll
keep taking Radiant History and stuff like that, but that's the end of the shit. Mm.
Greg, what about you, man? What you got?
Yeah, well, first of all, I guess I'll give what update I can on the Inazuma situation. The latest thing that we've heard now is basically that they might well be delaying it in the UK to possibly tie it into the anime, if that's getting localized or something, because there is a cartoon series of Inazuma 11 in Japan. But in terms of specifically about the UK bit, it's kind of like, yes, if you have a UK copy already, that must have been sent out by mistake. That's about it.
They're not asking people to send it back, are they?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that's going to be practicable. So, yeah, that's pretty farcical, I think you can agree.
Well, the good thing is, though, I mean, you thought that possibly they were trying to pretend like the game wasn't ever coming out or, you know, it sounds like not quite, not an Excitebot situation, but maybe they actually tried to hold it back at the last minute so they could do better and more marketing.
Maybe. In the UK, anyway. I mean, elsewhere in Europe, it seems like it's still been pretty quiet, and that's the launch that it's getting. And as I said, they haven't even localized it into those languages, so they're obviously not treating it very high priority there. But maybe they're going to come back to it and do something with it in the UK. But of course, clock's kind of ticking on DS stuff, so you might not want to take too long.
I'm just in awe that this game basically snuck out the front door, like in some outlets. Because I mean, we know that Carly has a copy of this game.
It's the UK copy, yeah, exactly. I love the way that the decision must have gone that close to the wire. Like, so are we sending these out or not? Screw it. Let's just send some out.
Somewhere in either Germany or in the UK, there is a warehouse full of UK copies of Inazuma 11.
Waiting.
Just waiting. Just sitting there.
Waiting for them to put a sticker on it that says, just like in the cartoon.
There's an Atari, there is an E.T. Atari situation going on somewhere in Europe right now.
if they wait so long and then something bad happens with the cartoon coming over, then they might actually have to bury them. It's pretty bizarre. I've not known anything like this before. But we'll move on now. So yeah, I've been playing a lot more Mega Man ZX Advent following on from last week. I'm pretty close to the end now, judging by the onslaught of bosses I've already fought.
The return trip.
In true Mega Man style. I've enjoyed it though, a great deal. I really like this. I mean, it's a bit uneven in some ways in that there's periods where bosses seem really quite difficult. And then there's other times where they seem curiously easy. Obviously, there's always been an element of that in Mega Man because of selecting levels. And, you know, once you get certain powers, you might be able to make a boss fight a lot easier for yourself. But given the structure of this game, it would seem as inevitable that you would get those kinds of erratic difficulty spikes because it is, as I said last week, it's got an exploration component to it, much less so than something like Metroid or whatever. I mean, you know, you've got these levels nested into the structure, and they are really fun action platformer levels for the most part. I mean, there's some that are a bit more kind of maze-like than you would expect from like a normal Mega Man game or something like that. So that's where it gets a bit more questionable that it's like, yeah, if you get to the boss and then die twice, you've got to do the whole thing again. The normal levels that are quite briskly paced and whatnot, you know, you're quite happy to go through them again if you have to. But if something where you're kind of feeling your way around and there's lots of like doors and exits to come through, that does not work so well. But in general, these levels are, you know, really well put together. You're a lot more deliberate than the corridors that populate a lot of the Castlevania games in the Igarashi era. So I like that, and the bosses are generally very good, but the best thing about the game is definitely the fact that you can take on all these different forms of the bosses. So when you kill them, you actually gain the ability to just turn into them, not just like use their weapon. And some of them are pretty much just like Mega Man, or the old Robot Masters in the early Mega Man games, but some of them are completely different, like gigantic characters, even, or like there's this one that's this guitar-playing General Grievous. Grievous-like thing that can glide is bizarre. But they're not all equally useful, but they all bring something to the table with the way the levels are designed. And you're just fun to experiment with in different situations, that's for sure. I mean, and some use quite innovative kind of things with the dual screens, like there's one particular that you can actually edit his weapon. So you could say, I want it to go up before it goes out, which could be very useful in fighting certain bosses, things like that. Or there's ones that have like radar that can see items, all sorts of things. So yeah, they make some pretty cool use of the dual screen in that regard, and in that way, I think as well, one of the big complaints that James had about the original ZX when he talked about it in the middle of last year.
The map,
yeah. And that was a common complaint, that it was basically useless. Now, in this game, it's definitely not useless. I mean, it's not the same way sort of Super Metroid, you know, the kind of auto map thing, you know, it's not like that. But you've just basically got two views of like the whole world and how these little sections connect together. And then you've got the sort of micro view, which is just the current room that you're in. And those are fine. They give you what you need to get around if you think, you know, I want to go to this particular point. So the only thing I would say about it is that there's this whole sort of range of adventuring kind of stuff with like fetch quests and stuff, which obviously I can't really get into because of the language barrier.
They're not worth it.
Although I've kind of done it by accident in quite a lot of cases. You could just tell by like the characters will have like speech bubbles or thought bubbles next to them that have a quest. And I just, oh, let's just go talk to them because I found some weird thing a bit ago. Oh, that sound effect sounded good. I probably just did something there.
It's a happy sound.
But it really doesn't affect your ability to play the game very much. And, you know, like all the dialogue and all the bad plot that, you know, that Johnny mentions in his eminently forgettable review was not a problem because you could just skip it with the press of the start button, and it's in Japanese anyway for me, so I've just been getting on with the action part of it as much as I can. But you still have a certain amount of like trotting back and forth around the central hub, which I'm not a really fan of. Like, if you could imagine Order of Ecclesia, you know, you've got the village in that.
Yeah.
Now imagine if that were several screens big and you kept sort of going from one bit to the other of it.
Well, this was an issue in the Mega Man Zero games as well. Right, James?
Yeah, that you'd end up with these, like, huge areas you had to walk around in just to get back to the headquarters, essentially.
I mean, it's not that intrusive or anything. It's not that bad. But Castlevania, you know, Order of Ecclesia, as I say, you've got pretty much the same thing. And it's two or three screens wide. And I can't help but think you could have condensed it into much the same thing here.
And even in that game, I don't really feel like it adds that much.
No, I mean, you could argue that perhaps you could streamline it further. But it certainly, at least, you know, without doing anything fundamental, you could just make it more manageable in that very easy way. Of just make it compact. But, I mean, the good thing about the sort of the exploration that it's brought in, it is revisiting the discrete levels with the new powers, because you will see things. It's like, there's no way I could get that now. And then you'll get a crazy power that you know, the cool thing about a game like this is that isn't in the series that I've played before, like, you know, Castlevania or Metroid, is you don't really know what to expect in terms of powers. So you'll get something where you actually, like, duplicate yourself. And that can pass through walls and get items that you previously couldn't get. And I wouldn't have seen that coming. So there were certain items that I was like, how on earth could I get it? You know, this power wouldn't get it, that power wouldn't get it. How am I going to get that? And then it turns out something like that. That kind of discovery is really cool. And playing through the levels again is generally not a chore because they're pretty well designed. Maybe not really right up there with the elite of the old Mega Man games, but they do have these different wrinkles with the using the powers, which for me is probably the most fun. Just, you know, they're testing them all, like they all look cool, they're animated well, and it's just great fighting a boss, looking at its attack patterns, thinking, by the time I beat him, I'm going to be able to do that. It's cool. Yeah. I really like it.
Yeah, and I think that feeling comes across better in this game. And I read my review after our debacle last week.
So. Your debacle last week.
It fired up certain neurons, and I'm remembering the game, I mean, through the lens of the review, obviously. But I do think that what you say, Greg, is really the key to this game's appeal. And I guess the first DX, too. But it's like when you're fighting a boss in the old Mega Man games, you see him use his little weapon, and sometimes it's cool, sometimes it's not, but a lot of the Mega Man bosses, even going back to the very first game, the actual bosses have certain movement capabilities and behavior patterns and, you know, ways that they can use the environment, that a lot of times that stuff isn't given to you along with the weapon. So, you know, you fight this really cool boss, and he does all this crazy stuff, and then you get his weapon, and it's like the most quantized, rinky-dink aspect of that boss's design. It's like The weapon isn't even what made him dangerous. It's the fact that he jumps all over the place, and he can stick to the wall, and he can reverse gravity, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think in the ZX games, because you can actually transform into the boss, not just use his one weapon. And that's the other thing, is a lot of the old Mega Man games, and this goes for X too, but a lot of the bosses have multiple weapons, and you basically only get one of them when you beat them. Now, in the Mega Man X games, sometimes they fix that by letting you charge it. You might have to get an upgrade that lets you charge your special weapons, but once you do that, sometimes you could use multiple versions of the weapon by charging it. But, in ZX, you get everything.
Right, well, I mean, cool. In Zero, though, they started introducing, like, Zero himself had different classes of weapon he had, and then the power-ups you got changed based on what type, like, you had that spear thing and the
grappling hook.
Yeah, all that weird stuff they started to throw in at the end, and they're like, we've made three of these. We probably should make something different.
All right, so John, tell us about that beta.
Yeah, I'm in I guess it's an open beta, right?
Yeah,
it's a Killzone 3 multiplayer beta. And, you know, I played a lot of Killzone 2, so I was curious to see. And, I mean, it's not a lot different, but the one major change they do make, and right now there's only one multiplayer level there, but it's a good mix of outdoors and indoors fighting and kind of like some close quarters stuff. The major change, I mean, one of the big complaints that people had about Killzone 2 was the controls. It was kind of like, they tried to make it feel like your character had weight rather than, you know, and he wasn't just some fast tank moving around that really didn't move very realistically. Like, I've always felt like games like Modern Warfare and Modern Warfare 2, when you kind of step back and think about how your character is moving around, he's not even moving around in a remotely realistic manner. Now, granted, you know, if you want to talk about first-person shooters in terms of realism, there's usually not a lot there.
No.
But, you know, in terms of controls, you know, typically your character does have a little bit of weight. And I thought Killzone 2 did a pretty good job of that, but I think they probably went a little bit overboard to the point where, like, your character kind of felt like he was a bit sluggish. Like, it went past the point of your character having weight and more to the point of your character just kind of having almost a little bit of a delay if you turned or tried to do anything.
Well, supposedly they have literally cut down the input lag. I think Digital Foundry proved this, you know, on the technical level. It is just, there is less input lag now.
Yeah, that's funny.
Which is something of a separate issue to weight.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have a problem with it, but probably because it suited me better, something slower, being, you know, not that familiar with shooters, but more responsive is good. I mean, even if it still has that kind of weight to it.
Yeah, it's kind of in between now.
If you're going to put weight on characters and shooters, shouldn't, like, the Gears of War characters not be mobile at all?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
They're basically elephants with guns.
Yeah. But then again, they are completely roided out. So.
That's right. They're all roided out. It's perfect. There are any pumping iron times 10.
But yeah, so they've definitely toned that down. And I mean, you move around a lot quicker in the environment now. It just feels better. Like, they toned down the kind of quote unquote realism, I guess. And its feel is more in line with, you know, other games like the Call of Duty series. So I think that people coming over from those series, with Killzone 2, I could have seen a lot of people coming over, especially from Modern Warfare, where the gameplay is so snappy. It's a borderline Twitch shooter. And, you know, people coming over to Killzone 2 and being like, oh my God, I feel like I'm, you know, walking around in cement. The one thing I haven't been able to experiment with too much is they've kind of made and, you know, a lot of the reviews have talked about this, about how, you know, you can stab people in the eye and stick your thumbs in, you know, people's eyes and stuff like that. I haven't tried that, but I think that all that is just, I think it may pick a random animation to go into when you do a, you know, kind of a close quarters attack on somebody, because I've had it done to me. I haven't done it to anybody, so I kind of know, like,
yeah,
how to do it. So I'm still kind of trying to experiment and sneak up on somebody to do it.
John, have you unlocked the jetpack yet?
I have not tried out the jetpack yet. I don't know if you can do that in the multiplayer, at least the one that they have open. I know you can, but I don't know if...
Mm-hmm.
I haven't found it, at least. It might be one of those things that's hidden off in some area that I haven't found yet.
You may just have to spend unlock points to get it.
Yeah, it might be.
Because I played some of this, too. We didn't play each other, but... I played a little bit of it today just because I knew John was going to talk about it, and I didn't play Killzone 2 at all. I mean, when I saw it at your place in Boston, it was the first time I'd ever seen Killzone 2. But, you know, I've been interested in, especially after hearing that it does have a jetpack.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was hoping I'd have access to that right off the bat, and I think you probably have to earn it by, you know, playing a bunch and getting your points and using those to unlock things. But my impression on it is I was surprised at the class-based gameplay.
Yeah.
Because that not very many first-person shooters have that right now. I've done it in Team Fortress 2, but yeah, in Killzone 3 you choose all these different classes. They all have specialized abilities and they start with different guns. So I found that I enjoyed playing as the medic, even though it's hard to kill guys with a medic because you run out of ammo really fast.
Yeah.
But you can earn points and basically you can contribute to the battle and get credit for that in a satisfying way by simply healing guys and reviving them when they fall down.
Yeah, you have a choice whether or not, you know, you kind of want to bleed out, or you can wait around and hopefully a medic comes and gets you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now there's not too many people playing comparatively to the way it was when Killzone 2 was really big. So medics aren't, I don't think really anybody chooses them, because typically there's not enough people around just passing by you to, like, kind of randomly heal you.
Mm-hmm.
But I was the same way. Like, that's what I used to pick. I used to typically pick medic.
Yeah, I really like playing as medic in Team Fortress 2 as well.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so different, you know? I mean, you could play as the soldier or whatever, and it plays like a lot of other first-person shooters, but suddenly you choose medic, and your whole goal in the game is completely different. It's like a different game. And it also doesn't feel like you're doing the same thing as everyone else on the battlefield. Like, you have this very specialized purpose. And the way other players behave around you is different, because they really want you to be close to them, so they'll be nice to you, and, you know, they want to protect you. And it's interesting. It's a way to, for me as a novice player, in any first-person shooter, I'm pretty much a novice player. So for me, playing as a medic is a way to get people to hang out with me on the map, basically.
Yep.
I know that sounds really pathetic, but if you choose a soldier, people basically will just split up, you know, especially if they're not using their headsets, they're not really communicating, they're not using teamwork, they basically just scatter and go off in all these directions. But if you're a medic, people want to stay near you, and so it basically just facilitates that team playing aspect that's what the game is designed around.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Killzone 2, they had squads where you could invite people to your squad, and so you could see them on the map. Like, you always kind of knew where your squad people were, and they always, I mean, if you were a medic, you would always get invited instantly.
I mean, the Battlefield games had those, but it never seemed to make a difference. People would always do the whole, all right, now that we're all in a squad, I'm going to go run off in every fucking direction imaginable.
Yeah, I mean, just because you
and then you're left in the helicopter by yourself.
Yeah.
I think one of the issues with these first-person shooters that are encouraging cooperative play and encouraging you to stick together is that in that first-person view, you have no peripheral vision. And so if you're kind of running into a big room, unless you're talking to each other more than you would if you were actually in that situation in reality, you really kind of have to spin around and see what everybody else is doing, or else just talk every single little detail out and say, I'm going up here, you go down there, let's stick together, we'll both go down this hallway.
Yep.
So it's difficult to visually keep track of where people are.
And I think the problem is that most people will have negative things to say about chatting in games.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just not fun. It's the race to mute everyone before the next match starts.
Yeah.
Well, so I can segue into another first-person shooter. I hope people don't mind, but mine's on the Wii. It's GoldenEye. Last Saturday, we had the Wi-Fi night. James, were you playing?
I did, but I could only get into games every... I got into a game with you, and then you left that game. I was like, damn it!
Oh, sorry. It's very confusing, especially if you have more than like 8 people, as we did. We had about 20 people, I think, total who were trying to play. It's just hard to manage the party thing because, you know, once you start a game, so the games can have up to 8 players in them, but you can only have 4 people in your party.
Yes.
So you can invite friends from your friends list into your party. You can get 4 people together. You say, okay, let's go start a game. And as soon as it starts, we'll tell everybody to find us on their friend list and join our game. But they can't, because in the matchmaking process of you starting that game, it fills it up with random people from everywhere else in the world. So basically you have all these other people who want to join your game, but they have to wait for a slot to open, which usually means they have to wait for the end of that current round for people to quit out because the rest of you suck or whatever,
right,
or you're too good. And usually 1 or 2 slots will open up, and then other people can try to pop in there. It was really a nightmare, and even with a dedicated chat room on our website to coordinate all this, it was still really hard to get everybody together. And plus, we had more people than could fit in one game, so we had 2 or 3 games going at any given time, and people were trying to kind of migrating from one group to another to, you know, so they could play with everybody. It was a mess.
I wasn't in the chat, but I was kind of monitoring it. What I noticed was that it was really hard just to get games going in general.
Yeah.
Like, I would invite everybody on the friends list, and that, you know, I'd get one, and then you'd go find a game, and then, exactly what I said, you get stuck with 6 guys who are apparently Latvian special forces and just mow you down.
Yeah, so I think the problems are myriad. First off, it's hard to get everybody on your friends list because you have all these damn codes that you're spinning around.
The invites, though, real quick on the friends code. Did I enter your friend code and then it sends you an invite and you just say okay?
No. We have to both enter each other's codes.
Oh!
I'm sure that's part of your problem. But then the next thing is the party size is only 4, which I commend the GoldenEye developers for actually having a party system, because a lot of Wii online games don't have anything like that, and it does help. If you have a group together and you want to play together, that having that feature helps a lot. So I really appreciate it, but it's kind of silly that the party size limit is 4 people when the game size limit is 8 people. I mean, I guess that means you could match up 2 parties together, but, you know, what if I wanted to have a game where it was just me and all my friends? We'd have to coordinate outside the game and divide ourselves into groups of 4 and lock all that down and have everybody know who their team is. It's just a mess, you know? And the other thing is the games only hold 8 people, which I think is, in this day and age, there should at least be a couple of maps that can have larger numbers of people. You know, then you're less likely to fill up the entire possible roster with random people, and so there might actually be slots open where other people can join in.
Yeah, I felt like the eight person limit didn't work on things like the statue park, but to the benefit of that, the statue park was the only level I could stay alive on. And I'm not bad at this game, but holy shit.
It's very fast paced, you know.
Yeah.
It is very Call of Duty style, and I think the gameplay of GoldenEye Online is great. It's not perfect, but it's great. The one thing I would change, aside from all the infrastructural crap that I just talked about, in terms of actual gameplay, the one thing I would change is that people need to have more and better choices of their loadout.
Yes.
Before they start leveling up. Because a huge problem that we ran into is that everybody's using the same guns. Because you don't really have anything to choose from until you get to level 20.
Right.
Before you actually have any real choices. So the problem is, 2 people see each other across a room, they start shooting each other, they both die at the same time.
Yes.
And that happens more often than not. And by that I mean, there were games where I had 20 kills, and more than 10 of them were situations in which I killed the other guy at the same time he killed me.
Yeah.
It happens all over the place.
Yes, it does.
It's really unnatural, the frequency of double kills in that game. I haven't seen it in any other first-person shooter. It's a balance issue, and I think it has to do with the way the weapons are unlocked.
Well, the other issue, though, is that because a lot of these guns are level locked, it goes back to the situation of rewarding players who are good with better guns.
Yeah, which, I mean, that kind of thing, you know, people have talked about that in Call of Duty. The way around that is that the guns that you unlock as you get deeper into it are more difficult to use. They're more specialized. And, you know, the gun that you start with is not bad.
No.
But it's the only gun you can use. That's the problem. If they just started with 3 guns available, they were all really balanced and there were pros and cons of each one. and they made it easy for you to choose which one to use every time, then you'd at least get like a paper, rock, scissors kind of set up with all the new players. And then as you get higher in level, then you unlock the more specialized things like sniper rifles and claymores and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff.
I know it's not Call of Duty-like, but I'd just rather it just be like old first-person shooters where there's just guns all over the fucking place. And you just, everybody starts with the crappy loadout and you have to go find stuff.
Well, then it's a race to the quad rocket launcher at the
well,
top
that's
of the
you
map.
Can't, you can't have it spawn in the same place, obviously.
Well, but then people complain because it takes the strategy out, because then it's luck. Oh, I got a good weapon. I'm lucky.
Eh.
Yeah.
So I appreciate them wanting to have it be strategic and have design into it, but just it's just not quite balanced enough. But I will say, I had a blast. I played for about 2 hours. We have some very good and some not so good players in the community. I don't know if any of those people listen to the show, but I had a really good time playing with people, and it was nice to have the chat room there because we could actually sort of communicate in between rounds. At one point, Neil handed out, I think it was a t-shirt or like a copy of Bloodstone for DS
he
or something.
We had two copies of DS Bloodstone, a t-shirt.
Yeah, but at one point, Neil gave out a prize for the first person to kill me with the golden gun.
Nice.
And we were able to track that, which was pretty cool. You know, I mean, unfortunately, that particular prize was limited to the people who were in the game with me at the time, which was less than the total number of people playing, but that's just the way it works, I guess. But there was some fun stuff. There's a guy named Rob's a Beast who was a beast. I mean, he was really good.
Yeah.
And every time I killed him, I felt amazing. Because a lot of times it was lucky, but sometimes I actually killed him because I played well. And yeah. I did win one round, which I was really surprised by. It was on a map where I felt like I was doing poorly. And then at the end, I was like, whoa, how'd that happen? But I think the star mode, and I've played all of them at this point. My favorite mode by far is Golden Gun, which is not one that I ever played back on the N64. I mean, I just didn't think it was all that interesting back then. On the Wii version online, it's amazing, because when you have 8 players on the map, the golden gun, everybody always knows where the golden gun is. There's an indicator that always tells you where it is, and everybody wants it because you get tons of points if you kill somebody with it. So it's basically just a magnet, and it just sucks all of the players in the match towards one place. And chaos reigns. Chaos reigns at that at that one locale. So, and it just it keeps everybody together. So even on the maps that are just too big, it keeps everybody going to the same place, and it makes it very hard to hold on to the golden gun for very long because everybody's coming after you. You have a giant target, but you also have this powerful weapon, and you get tons of experience when you kill people with it. So it's that mode is terribly fun, I think. I have a couple other Wii games to mention. I'm done with Sonic Colors now. I was ready to come onto the show and give like a really positive final wrap-up until I played some more of it today.
And now I hate it.
I don't hate it, but I thought I would finish the game. I thought I would try to play all the levels because I was having a really good time with it. And today, I just got to a certain point in the game where I don't know if they're trying to ramp up the difficulty or what, but the game is split up in all these different worlds, and at any given time, you might be able to select levels from multiple worlds. So at the point I was, I had 3 worlds where I could go play levels on, my choice. And I ran into levels on all 3 of these worlds that were infuriating. That I tried multiple times. I couldn't get through them because of shitty design or just control snafus. You know, a lot of dying and not sure why I died, or screaming at the game because I jumped and it didn't jump. And after a while, I was just like, fuck this, I'm done. I mean, I played it for like an hour trying to get through this stuff. I was not having fun. And I said, okay, this game's going back. So, I don't know. I am still really impressed by it, but I don't know if it's just that the later levels didn't get as much polish, or if in trying to make them more challenging as you get deeper into the game, they actually just made them more bullshitty, but they are more bullshitty, for certain. And the thing that Greg has complained about a lot, especially in the Mario games and Donkey Kong and all this, is the whole idea of you having a certain finite number of lives being outdated is a serious problem in Sonic. Because you can beat a level with 1 life left and then turn the game off and come back to it the next day and you play the next level and you die and you get a game over screen.
Yeah, at that point, it's like if you ever find yourself in that situation, where you're starting a level with like one or no lives, you may as well just kill yourself there and then so that you can restart the whole thing with the maximum number of lives that you'd start with just to better preserve checkpoints and stuff, which is, stupid.
I did that in Mega Man 2 in the 80s.
Yeah, any time you have an incentive structure that encourages you to kill yourself, we have a problem.
Yes, exactly. It's really infuriating, and I found places where there were checkpoints that the momentum of the level would take me over them so that they wouldn't activate.
Nice!
Yeah, because you do physically have to, there's like a little gate, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like the little flag thing in Super Mario World, the ticker tape that you have to pass through, except in this game, you blaze by it at 100 miles an hour.
it can do.
Barely see it.
I think it was maybe twice that happened, but it's, twice too many, one could argue.
Yeah.
It really should just be if you pass a point.
Yeah, check. I mean, especially exactly. In this, because it's so visually busy in addition to being very fast. So those things, those little gates don't necessarily stick out all that much.
Yeah, I remember when Sonic Colors first came out, people were comparing it to Mario Galaxy and maybe accusing it of imitating Galaxy, which in general, I wish more games would imitate Mario Galaxy. I don't really have a problem with that, but in terms of the music, there are some hilarious similarities. I mean, really blatant type rip-off melodies. Just the instrumentation and the way the music's put together. I feel like Sonic has always, if you go back to the very first game, it's always had a very distinct musical presentation. And yeah, I guess you get into the like Dreamcast and Last Generation era, and it was known for these shitty pop vocals and
the singing.
Whatever. There's one song like that in this game, but it's like the it's like the title screen song.
Yeah, it's for the CG intro. Yeah.
Yeah, it's easy to skip. After that, it pretty much sounds exactly like Super Mario Galaxy.
But nowhere near as good.
No, but it's just a blatant imitation.
It is some bits that have a bit more of its own personality. But yeah, it's not one of the stronger Sonic soundtracks even that I've played. Like sort of like Sonic Rush. I know TYP's not a huge fan of the soundtrack to that. It's still by the guy that did Jet Grind Radio. It's just very distinctive, though.
Yeah.
Even for someone who hasn't played many Sonic games, that felt like a Sonic soundtrack to me, whereas this doesn't.
So, and the last thing I wanted to say about Sonic Colors is that I got to the water world, and I was like, oh, no.
Mandatory.
Well, yeah. All the levels are mandatory, pretty much. But
no, I mean that there's a water world. It's mandatory.
Yeah, there's always got to be a water level.
Yeah, but I'm...
unless it's DKC, DKC Returns, they had the balls to issue the water world.
Yeah.
Screw you, Costner.
The water levels in Donkey Kong Country are somewhat infamous. I would say the water levels in Sonic the Hedgehog series are incredibly infamous.
Yeah, I would say that is they might be primarily responsible for me not playing a Sonic game between the years 1992 and 2005.
Yeah. Oh, they're horrible. I mean, the underwater stages in Sonic games are horrible. I mean, I would say they're almost as bad as the one in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. In terms of, like, that's usually the level I get to where I never get past it. So, I have to say that in Sonic Colors, they made a few tweaks, and the water levels in this game are actually fun.
No, I thought so too. I mentioned this when I talked about it because you get the drill power up, which you could kind of like submarine through the water levels to quite a large extent, which makes them pretty fun, much faster paced than your typical underwater level.
Yeah, they're fun. It's kind of like getting the dolphin, or the swordfish in Donkey Kong. But yeah, I really like those levels for the most part. I did get to one later on that I couldn't find the drill for, so I actually had to play through it as Sonic, and that was interesting because the breath mechanic becomes a lot more important because you don't move through the water as quickly, so Sonic can drown.
You still get the same music as well for when he's running out of air.
The freak out panic music when you're about to run out of air. And I think it's about 30 seconds, so it's a little more generous than I remember from the original Genesis games.
Yeah.
But it's still very frustrating when you drown. I mean, it just feels bad. It feels like, well, I was exploring the level, I was trying to find the stuff that you obviously put there for me to find, but there was no air there, so I died. So, fuck you, game. I mean, it's just not, I understand why they do it that way, but it's not a rewarding game design to make Sonic drown because you wanted to explore the level. This is like me following a line of rings. Clearly, mm-hmm. there is something up here that I should be able to get, and yet it's almost impossible to get it without drowning. You know, like you'd have to know that that's a dead end and plan for it, and there's no way to do that. It's trial and error.
Well, I mean, aren't a lot of the old Sonic games trial and error anyway?
Yes, James, but I think we've established that I don't like that stuff. So.
I know. I mean, they're basically giving Sonic fans what they apparently, for some reason, want.
Oh, no, actually, I went to GameFAQs at one point because it wasn't an underwater, there was a roller coaster level where the only way to beat it is by using the dash power constantly to get away from this thing that's chasing you.
Oh, yeah, I remember this.
Yeah, I was like, it wouldn't let me jump. I could switch lanes, but there was no way to avoid him. I was like, what am I supposed to do here? I died there like 10 times.
It's bizarre that it just doesn't have like a button prompt there just to tell you to use the dash, like just at the very beginning and then go.
Yeah, I ended up going to GameFAQs and I looked at their message boards, and the message board is basically full of Sonic fans complaining about this game, about how it's too easy, about how it doesn't have as many characters as all the other Sonic games. I mean, they're basically begging for all the shit that was fixed. They're basically complaining about everything that was fixed. I'm like, my complaints about this game are minuscule compared to Sonic
fans.
They
are incredulous regardless of what you give them.
I guess. I mean, Sonic Colors it's still, I would say, a very flawed game, but it is undeniably a step in the right direction. They almost made a Sonic game that I can totally get behind and really love. And, you know, after seeing the top 10 MPD charts for the year 2010, Sonic Colors didn't even crack the top 10 for Wii. So I don't know that Sega is going to put as much money into next year's game or this year's game.
Yeah, well, I think they said that Sonic Colors sold like nearly 2 million units or something. But the thing that was unclear about that is whether they were combining the DS and Wii SKUs.
Probably.
Because I assume they were, because they did specify one of them.
I mean, I do think Sega's taken a nice step forward into modern gaming with Sonic Colors, and I worry that with the next game, they're either going to take a step backwards or just stagnate, because they're like, well, we put a lot more money into last year's game, and it didn't sell any better than the one before, so what's the point?
Just put less money into it.
One final comment, though, on Sonic Colors, and I'm sure that Greg noticed this, but there is a bizarre inconsistency in the length of the levels.
Yes.
Some levels take more than 10 minutes to get through. They have multiple checkpoints, which those are the really frustrating ones when you run out of lives.
Yeah, because you have a long way to make back up then.
Exactly. And there are levels that you can beat in about 30 seconds, even if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, so that's very odd.
It's my understanding that's kind of a Sonic thing in the 3D games, though.
That's really strange. Really strange. Like, I can understand it in Galaxy when certain stars that you get are based on, like, mini-games, you know, or a race.
Yeah.
But these are platforming levels that are, like, 30 to 45 seconds long.
They're just shorter. They're fundamentally the same. They're just shorter.
Yeah, they're the same as the other levels, except
it counts as variety.
It's really weird. And then some of them are so long. They're too long. Some of them are way too long. Anyway, Sonic Colors is a weird game. You should try it. Another game you should try, I don't have a whole lot new to say about it, but I did play more Fluidity this week, and I posted about this on our Facebook page. It just reminded me about how amazing this game is, and still people haven't discovered it. I don't think this game has any word of mouth. I mean, not in the media for certain. I mean, I was hoping that maybe it would be something that people discover like a month later or 2 months later. And it doesn't seem to be happening. It's really a shame because I played a few more hours of it this week, and that game does not get worse, let me tell you. the ingenuity. I mean, I think it has to be one of the cleverest games I've ever played. And it's so long. I've played it for well over 10 hours at this point. I'm about halfway through. So it's stunning. It's a stunning game. If this was $40, I would be completely fine with that. It's $12. It's an amazing game. Amazing. And I really think people should go play it. We have an email coming up that mentions it later, so that's all I'll say. Finally, I have a game that I've never talked about before, and it's a weird one. It's called Cthulhu Saves the World. which is not something that you'd think Cthulhu would do, and that's that is the starting point of the humor in this game that's so amazing. It's an Xbox Live indie game, and it costs $3. Of course, it comes with a free trial, and the free trial is like, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes long, and by the end of it, this game had already made me laugh out loud multiple times, and that's basically why I bought it. I mean, I could tell what kind of game, it's a 16-bit RPG, it's a retro-style RPG, but the writing in it is so good. I mean, the game is just legitimately funny in a way that I would not have expected. The premise of the game is that Cthulhu is awoken, and he's getting ready to destroy the Earth and make all of humanity go insane before they die. And right before that happens, some unknown wizard casts a spell on him that takes away all of his powers. So he's basically shrinks down to human size, and he looks the same, but he's not scary anymore. He doesn't have any of his old magic. And then the narrator of the game literally has a conversation with Cthulhu and says, hey, if you want to get all your power back so you can destroy the world, you need to become a hero in order to break this spell. That's the only way you're going to get your evil powers back is by doing good deeds. And so Cthulhu embarks on a quest to save the world so that he can destroy the world. It's amazing. The very first character that you find to add to your party is basically a groupie. Like, she has the hots for Cthulhu, and she's a magic user. So that's the first person you add, and the banter between them is great. And then throughout the game, there's a number of times where you have to fight a boss at the end of a dungeon, and at the end of the battle, you basically have a conversation with the guy and persuade him to join your party. So by the end of the game, about half the members of your crew are formerly vanquished boss enemies. And they're really powerful, too. The nice thing about Cthulhu Saves the World is that it looks kind of like Final Fantasy IV or maybe like a 16-bit Dragon Quest game, but it plays in a much more modern way. I mean, it is still very much rooted in that old-school RPG style, you know, Japanese RPG, but they've added a lot of modern conveniences, like you can dash really fast to get around the map. After you've fought 25 battles in any given area, you won't fight any more random battles. You can fight it, but you can call a fight from the menu if you want to fight more guys. But once you've sort of proven your dominance over an area, your ability to survive through 25 battles, it just turns that off. And so then you can explore freely and find all the treasure chests and everything, which is very nice.
Yeah.
It has a really cool system where every time your characters get a level up, it gives you two choices. I mean, you'll get like more hit points and more magic. But in terms of stats and abilities and things like that, it always gives you two choices. So it's a little bit like Paper Mario, how it always gives you a choice of what to upgrade. Whereas in Cthulhu, you're going to learn a new spell that blinds enemies. You can either get a version that blinds one enemy but has like an 80% chance of succeeding, or you can get one that blinds a group of enemies but only has a 60% chance of succeeding. And they might have different costs as well in terms of magic points. So there's some really clever stuff like that. Also, your hit points refill at the end of every battle and all your characters come back to life. So the only depletable resource is magic points, and magic points also regenerate a certain amount after every battle. So it encourages you to use a lot of abilities and magic points, but not too many, because over time you'll use them all up if you don't let them regenerate for a while. And also, because you are Cthulhu, you can make the enemies insane, which is great. And the art changes. So there's two versions of the artwork for every enemy. There's one normal version and one insane version. And when they're insane, usually they do less damage and they may take more damage, but certain enemies can actually become more powerful and they could become insane. And then different characters also have passive abilities, like your agility might go up based on the number of enemies that are insane at any given time. It's really, really good. It's really well made. It's also pretty long. I'd say I've played it for like 15 hours and I'm not quite finished with it yet. And it costs $3. So, if you like 16-bit RPGs, if you like indie games, I think this one's excellent. And it's coming to PC later this year too. So, definitely check out Cthulhu Saves the World. Oh, and the music. Oh, the music's excellent. You can download the soundtrack for free. I'm going to send it to TYP because I know he likes that kind of thing. And he's going to get a kick out of it. Very, very awesome music. Okay, that's the end of New Business. And when we come back, we have your listener mail lightning round. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
So we have a feature on, well, the continuation of the Games We Want feature for the handheld virtual console. This time we've added entries from people like Neil, Lauren, John, our new hire Josh, Aaron, and TYB. We also have a blog from Carly with the earlier discussed Inazuma 11 and its hilarious opening, now in English. And one other note, Nintendo World Report is currently hiring 3 positions, including staff writer, news editor, and a new downloads editor position. So go to the site and check that out.
Yeah, if you'd like to do hard work for no money, just like us, then you can be part of the team.
you can live the dream.
John lived the dream, and now I live the dream.
In reviews this week, we start off with Tron Evolution Battle Grids for Wii from Aaron, and Jam City Roller Girls for WiiWare from Andy.
And wrapping up reviews, we got Call of Duty Black Ops for Wii from Pedro. And we also have feature Extra Life Solar Striker. Zach tells us about Solar Striker.
All right, we've got impressions of the 3DS launch title, or launch window title, Steel Diver. I think it looks really cool, and so does Jared Rosenberg, who wrote a very nice article about that. We also have an in-depth preview of Radiant Historia, the new Japanese RPG from Atlas for the DS that's coming out later in February, and Nathan Mustafa got to watch a video conference of the game being played, and basically got a ton of information about it. So you can find out all about Radiant Historia. I think James is going to be playing that pretty soon, right?
Hopefully.
It sounds really cool. It's been compared a lot to Chrono Trigger. Yeah, we'll see if that holds up. And finally, I certainly hope it does. And finally, we actually have the first 30 minutes of Conduit 2 in video format, so you can get a very in-depth look at the upcoming, well, eventually Conduit 2 is coming out, and you can learn all about it now by watching the video. 30 minutes of video for that game. So it's all over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Be sure to go check it out. Alright, welcome back to the program. It's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And we've gotten so much email in the past couple weeks. Of course, we didn't have mailbag last week due to retroactive, and we probably won't next week. So I wanted to get in as many emails as possible. So we're going to try this. We're going to try a lightning round. Basically, I cut down, and I have to apologize in advance. If your letter's read on this show, I probably cut out 75% of it. Because I want to get through as many of these as we can. We're not going to have as lengthy discussion type answers as we normally do. So we're going for volume here probably, but hopefully we will get to your letter. If you've sent an interesting letter, especially if it's your first time, I tried to get it in here, and we have a lot to go through. We're going to try to hit them all. So James has the first letter.
Shaman from Dartmouth, Nova Scotia writes, "The 25th anniversary of Zelda and Dragon Quest and the 15th anniversary of Pokemon are all coming up in 2011. Do we have another set of ROMs on a disc to look forward to that will end up being $90 on the secondary market? And does a company with Nintendo's history have an obligation to do more to honor their history?"
It would be nice if they did. If they did something more than just the bare minimum.
Well, I mean, they did some nice Iwata asks for the Mario anniversary. They're still doing some, actually. And some of them are kind of informative and interesting, but I mean, they're not blowouts or anything.
Unfortunately, I can't play any Iwata asks. Although I wish I could. It would probably be pretty fun.
The Mario anniversary collection is pretty bad. I'm not impressed with it. I don't know why people are... I guess they just printed a very small number, and that's why the value's gone up.
Pretty much. I mean, it's the same reason that the Zelda collector disc that had all the games on it is worth a ton of money, because you can only get it in GameCubes.
Really? I think I still have mine. Oh, no, maybe not, if it only came with a system.
Yeah, that was the one that came with the Silver System.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, with Zelda, they've already done that. So
yeah,
I don't
many
think
times.
They
yeah.
release a bunch of ROMs on a disc. I've already got 2, actually. I've got one that I guess I have one that only has Ocarina and the Master Quest.
Master Quest
for
yeah.
Ocarina, and then I've got the other one that has all the games on it.
I could see them releasing it again, though, I guess, for retail.
Well, I'd like to see, like, if Skyward Sword actually does come out this year. It'd be cool if they had, like, an actual collector's edition of it.
No!
With 25th anniversary. I mean, far be it for me to talk about stuff like that, but, you know, I'd like to see that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you've got, it should be a pretty big year for Zelda as it is, with Ocarina 3D and Skyward Sword, if that makes it. I mean, it might be a little difficult fitting in, like, a whole separate product.
Right.
Yeah, and they've got Link's Awakening DX as well coming out.
Yeah, that's going to be on the Virtual Console.
Yeah, I mean, with the Ocarina 3D remake, if they do a really good job and actually make it feel like a top-to-bottom remake, then that would be good enough for me. And especially if it includes some really cool bonus features, like maybe some text information, some videos of Aonuma talking about the game. It's the kind of thing that Nintendo doesn't really do, but if they package some of that stuff with the game itself, that would be really cool, and that would, you know, that would almost make the Ocarina remake for 3DS feel like its own collector's package. You know, it's like a tribute to that game. It is one of the most important games ever made, so it's certainly the type of thing where you could do that kind of project, but that's not really Nintendo's style.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing is that it is being held over for after the launch window. Reggie's already committed it to coming out after E3.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's not quite the ultimate rush job of just getting into the launch window, so maybe there's some hope for something like that. But as you say, it just, whether it's Nintendo's obligation to do that sort of thing or not, they just don't generally tend to do much.
It's not an obligation, it's an opportunity for them to make a lot of money and endear their fans, and they don't, I guess they made some money on the Mario anniversary thing.
They'd make a lot more if they're selling them at street value right now.
Yeah.
But I don't think that project did a whole lot to endear their fans. Actually, I think it probably did the opposite for the most part. So I think they could do a much better job of it. Not that they have an obligation, but they have an obligation to their shareholders to make a lot of money on these type of anniversaries.
Well, they did the Red Wii, and I think that was kind of neat. It was a nice little commemorative piece.
Yeah, and the XL, and even a regular DSi. There was quite a lot of products.
Yeah, I mean, they pushed a lot of Mario stuff for the anniversary. I could see them making an anniversary Zelda that maybe comes bundled with one or two of the Zelda DS games. And they've made Zelda-themed handhelds for every generation, so why wouldn't they make a DSi XL that actually has the entire mass of the Triforce in it?
I can see the 15th anniversary of Pokemon being a big deal in Japan, where they have the theme park and the, you know, they have multiple stores.
Right. So that, I'm sure they'll do something for Pokemon in Japan. But I mean, they're still knee deep in Black and White there. I mean,
yeah, exactly. I mean,
they're still rolling out product for Black and White in Japan, who's had the game for a while.
It's pretty much a constant barrage of Pokemon product, though, in Japan. I mean,
there's a whole, isn't there a weekly TV series?
There
just
is a
about
weekly Pokemon live action Sunday TV series that is basically the Pokemon news show. Yes.
Yeah, they don't exactly need to revive interest in that franchise. With Zelda, there's a little more work to be done there. For Dragon Quest, 25th anniversary of Dragon Quest is amazing. That's awesome. And, you know, Square Enix is a different company than Nintendo. They are probably even more proactive about re-releasing their games.
Oh,
so
God, yes.
Yeah. At this point, especially with 6 coming out in late February in North America and Europe for the first time ever.
I don't know whether it's confirmed for Europe.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I mean, it's definitely not coming out at the same time, I can tell you that.
No,
much.
It's
whether
not.
Whether it will ever come out is another matter.
Yikes. Well,
can you say import,
you can import
market
it at least. I mean, it will be in English for the first time, so.
Yes.
English speakers can.
Screw you, Italians!
Yeah. But that's a very big deal. I mean, that means for the first time, people in America and even in Europe will basically have access to the entire series for the first time ever. So, I mean, I think that is a celebration unto itself, but. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think Square Enix is going to release like a collection of Dragon Quest games because they seem to be doing fine releasing them one at a time. What I could see them possibly doing is making a push to actually start releasing the old Dragon Quest games on Virtual Console.
Yeah, I mean, they've crossed that line, especially in Japan with Final Fantasy games. I mean, they're up to 5 on Super Famicom Virtual Console.
Well, they've got 4 Dragon Quest NES games that were actually localized in the 80s and 90s. So
yeah, I mean, Dragon Quest, obviously, that, you know, the anniversary itself and the history, it's the nostalgia. I mean, it's so much more of a Japanese thing. I mean, Pokemon too, but this especially, I'm not sure. that the North American market, even though DQ9 has done well and stuff, is it would support this kind of second order level of product that we might be talking about with an anniversary.
You know, let's move on to the next letter, Greg.
Kyle from Lancaster, England writes, "Lately I've been browsing for and collecting second-hand games and have amassed a respectable stack of last and current-gen games. Glancing over my shelf of shame, I can see many unplayed games and even more than the odd collector's editions. With a rising pit of disgust welling in my stomach, I fall to my knees and with a tremulous cry I have realised... my God, I have become John Lindemann, destroyer of worlds."
Destroyer of worlds.
It did sound a bit like I have become death, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. I thought it had like an Edgar Allan Poe kind of vibe to it.
John's collection of games is sort of like the first Atomic Mushroom Cloud.
I'm doing the wink and the gun
right
Lindemann
now. It's Lindemann syndrome. It's spreading. It's happening.
It's viral. Look, we've gone viral.
I tell all people who amass the collection of games, because I got a lot of games, just play through them. You don't. If you play them, it's not Lindemann syndrome.
That's the thing. Just start one at a time. Just make it manageable for yourself.
Lindemann syndrome is getting the game and putting it on the shelf and then coming back to it 3 years later when the second sequel to that game is getting ready to come out this year.
I regret nothing.
But buying the collector's edition initially
now,
anyway.
I would like to say that in my defense, I have slowed down considerably
on buying games.
Yeah, but isn't this just like the whole deficit national debt issue? It's like, yes, if the deficit is shrinking, all that means is that the debt's growing at a slower rate. It's not very good.
Right.
You know, actually, I thought about this earlier today, and I'm having trouble keeping up with my games too. And for me, the problem is actually all the download platforms that I have access to now, because I've got 3 consoles and a PC with Steam. And there are games coming out every week. I mean, there aren't that many games that come out on disc. I mean, in a given month, probably one game that I would actually even consider buying comes out on a disc.
Mm-hmm.
But every single week, there are these really cool $5, $10 games coming out on all the download platforms, and I can't help myself.
They nickel and dime you into the syndrome,
they almost
buddy.
All have demos now. I have trouble even finding time to play through all the demos that I download.
But if they're not wrapped, is it Lindemann syndrome?
Well, no. It's something different, I guess.
I don't have that many wrapped games. All right.
That many.
John, you have the next letter.
One. All right.
It showed up yesterday.
Okay, Wyatt in New Hampshire writes, "A few weeks ago, we learned that Dead or Alive Dimensions is going to be 30 frames per second with 3D mode on and 60 frames per second with it off. It is also reported that Super Street Fighter 4 3D Edition has a frame rate boost with the 3D mode off. Are you concerned that this will be a common issue? Do you think the 3D novelty is worth the difference, or do you think you might turn it off for a more fluid experience?"
Okay, so I actually transcribed the roundtable this came out of, so I'm going to explain it like they explained it. Basically, what they're saying is they're still processing all of the frames. They're still being rendered, but they're only going to show half of them, essentially. Now, what this means is it won't be nearly as jerky as if it was slowdown, because the frames are still being created. They're just not being pushed to the screen. So it may be a little bit of a downgrade from 60 frames per second, but it's not going to be what you would normally think of. Oh my God, we lost half our frame rate.
That would also mean that if you're playing online, for instance, or even local wireless, you can have one player playing with 3D on and the other playing with it off, and they should match up well.
Yes.
And the only difference would be that if the player with 60 frames per second is able to see differences in animation within 1/60th of a second.
Right. Which your eye cannot...
Then he would have an advantage
over
the other
player. Which your eye cannot process.
Still, I mean, you could see people thinking, you know, the effect that it has on battery life as well. You know, maybe they don't, if they're playing for a sustained period, maybe they don't want to look at 3D for that long.
Eye strain.
Whether it has a tangible eye strain effect or whether it's something more psychological. Either way, you could definitely see people being inclined to switch it off at various times, which, you know, even so, it's good that it's got the switch and all that. That's a nice thing it has. But of course, what's not optional is the fact that, you know, when you pay for the 3DS, you're paying a premium price in large part because of the 3D, because of the screens that are in it, etc. Yeah. So
yeah,
it's not so much going to be on a case-by-case basis, but, you know, sort of an accumulation, like a critical mass of people who buy a 3DS going to use the 3D enough across all the games that they feel like it was worth paying that premium they paid.
I think they will. I mean, I think this factor only really matters to people who are like really hardcore about their fighting games.
Well, and to be honest, 3DS isn't really for them. The 3DS version.
Well, it can be if you turn it off. I mean, I think it's fine that it caters to both people, but see, you know, I think most people who buy Super Street Fighter 4 3D Edition are going to play it in 3D because 3D is in the name of the game and the system, and that's why they bought the system, and that's why they bought that game. They want to see it in 3D.
I view the Street Fighter 4 3D Edition as sort of a... this is a version for... that's not meant for, like, the people who participate in the... whatever the name of that stupid tournament is every year.
Evolution, Evo.
This is the version for the casual fan.
I'm sure they're going to try and reach out to some extent, but at the same time, you know, people who are like Street Fighter junkies or something, they might like to play it on the go as
sure.
well.
Yeah.
And when they do, they might like it to be as approximate to their sort of full fat experience as possible. So, I mean, I could see people, you know, maybe factoring in it as a concern. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem to be a huge deal necessarily, but I'm just talking about the more macro phenomenon of, are people going to ultimately, once the novelty wears off and practical concerns like battery life and frame rate become, you know, more of an issue in people's minds, whether the 3D is actually more seldom used than you might think?
Here's the thing. These games that we're discussing that have this performance difference with 3D on are launch titles.
Yeah.
They're basically launch titles, or their launch window. So I think this will become less of an issue as the development of the platform matures, because the reason this is happening is that the system can barely run these games at 60 frames per second.
Right.
With the 3D off. That's why there's a performance hit. Once you've optimized your engines and you understand the hardware well enough to make so that the system could run the game at 100 frames per second, then you can run it with 3D on or off. And either way, it's still above 60.
Right.
So basically, once your engines are optimized enough, then this won't be an issue
anymore.
It's
better. It's always better if the frame rate is lower and steady than
yes,
higher.
Consistency is yeah. right. the issue, I think, especially in fighting games or something like that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Fighting games and then the, like, really hardcore platforming.
It's why some people
games.
Actually go on about PAL versions of certain Super Famicom games being preferable, because it runs at a slower speed to begin with. So when you get these hardcore troughs in games like Super R-Type, it's not such a trough on the PAL version, and people actually prefer it that way.
I don't think you're going to see these performance hits on first-party titles.
No.
Because
no.
I think Nintendo's going to optimize the game so that they'll run at 60 frames no matter what.
Or they'll find, if they can't get it to 60 frames in the 3D, they'd find it somewhere where it can run on both and not allow it to do the jump, essentially.
Yeah.
They'd say, all right, 40 is as high as we can get it, so it'll be 40 on or off.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so the next letter's from Adolf in Texas, and he writes, now that Pilot Wings Resort is coming for 3DS and it uses that Woohoo Island, I'm really curious about this franchise. I'm curious what makes it so special and beloved. Can RFN please discuss this franchise in detail?
Helicopter rescue missions. There we go.
I think it's very apt, really, because we just found out in Europe anyway, it's going to be a launch day title,
yes.
not just a
nice.
Launch window title. It isn't in Japan, but obviously that's a whole month earlier, so it might mm-hmm. be out in Japan by March 25th. But to me, the biggest thing about Pilot Wings, when you think of it, is system launches. It was a very early title for the Super Famicom, and it was a launch title for N64. So a lot of the time, it's about showing off what a system could do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, you know, in some ways, probably a lot of people who, you know, might not otherwise have bought that kind of game end up buying it. And, you know, they might really get to like it just because they're kind of forced to play it in a way. You know, and we might have some of the same kinds of things with Pilot Wings Resort on 3DS.
It has a lot more competition in the 3DS launch lineup than it did for either Super Nintendo or N64.
It certainly does, yes. Although, I mean, it's still, first party wise, it doesn't. It's just Nintendogs. But yeah, the third parties are much more involved than they were on those two console launches. But Yeah, I mean, I've played both of them. They both have a bit of a tech demo kind of feel to them, especially the Super Nintendo one. But the N64 one, you know, what I liked about that was just the amount that you could just kind of screw around with it, you know, in the various different modes. You know, there was just little Easter eggs to find, and it had quite a freeform kind of nature to it, which is quite unusual at the time.
If you like the free flight mode in Wii Sports Resort, where you fly all over the island and just find the little info bubbles, Pilot Wings is basically a whole game of that. So, I mean, there are challenges where, you know, you have an objective, but there's also just a lot of opportunity to basically goof around, explore a space, and there's a lot of different vehicles that all control very, very differently. They all handle differently. So there's just a lot of variety. I mean, it's a bit of a mini-game package, but the mini-games tend to be less structured than in, you know, they're not patterned after competitive sports so much as it is, here's a hang glider, fly around for as long as you can without touching the ground.
It's meant for people to get used to 3D.
Yeah, it's always been that. You know, you had the Mode 7 faux 3D, you had the polygonal 3D worlds of N64, and now you've got stereoscopic 3D. I mean, the only thing I would say is just compared to 64, is this going to have the same kind of variety of environments and tasks and stuff, given that it's just set on the Wii Sports Resort Island? You know, because you had, like, I think, was it four different environments on N64? Including the one that was a miniature United States that was pretty funny to mess around in. So, I'm not sure whether it will quite measure up. It's funny, we are this close, and yet I still don't feel like we know that much about
it. We know very little about it.
Unless it is just that insubstantial. In which case, if they're charging like $40 or £30 for it, it's a bit of a joke, but we'll see.
I do think, though, that it's funny because we all knew once we saw Wii Sports Resort Airplane Mode, at least I know I did, and I believe John Eve said the same thing, that, well, there's your next Pilot Wings game.
Well, I couldn't believe, I thought Pilot Wings would have come out on Wii a lot earlier because even the very first time I played Wii back at E3 2006, they were showing off these Wii, you know, motorsports.
Yes.
And some of that stuff ended up in Resort, but yeah, I'm surprised. You know, I was surprised they didn't do one for GameCube. I was surprised they didn't do one for Wii. So I'm glad Pilot Wings is coming back. I think it's a quirky series. It is very kind of freeform and just explore and make your own fun. And the game has a very lighthearted, free-spirited sort of atmosphere to it. The music and the graphics and everything it's a little bit cartoony, but it's just fun. It's very pleasant. It's meant to be sort of relaxing. And the game, this is the first Pilot Wings game in 15 years. So this really is a revival. I'm very happy to see Pilot Wings
finally come
back.
I'd be interested to see how much of its own personality survives or, you know, is kind of renewed when, you know, you've got Miis. It's a place from existing games. I don't know whether it'll just feel more like a Wii Sports spin-off than Pilot Wings.
I do think, though, that the Woohoo Island setting does kind of fit.
Yeah. Oh,
it's the first of the four places in Pilot Wings 64 is quite a lot like Woohoo Island in itself.
Mm-hmm. Now that we've explored Woohoo Island in two other games, Wii Sports Resort and to some extent Wii Fit Plus.
On the Segway.
Yeah, or a bicycle. The bicycle mode's kind of cool, actually. But
the Segway mode's kind of awful.
Yeah, it is. Now that we've already played two other games with Woohoo Island, I do expect that Pilot Wings Resort needs to expand the island. You know, they've discovered new sections of it.
Oh, God, it's not lost.
It's just...
Would it be a volcanic eruption?
50 years later, and things have changed, but they can't just use the same environment over and over and over across...
Well, you're on an airplane. You could fly to other islands. I mean...
Yeah, really.
Well, there are other islands even in Resort, but they're fairly close. I'm just saying, let Woohoo Island be kind of a concept and not a
place.
Not a place that is locked into design so that it looks and is shaped exactly the same every day.
I really liked exploring that island, though.
Me too.
They would need to, at the very least, make it as tightly populated as its predecessor.
More so, because we've already explored that island. I don't need to do it again with a jetpack. It's not
that much different. I disagree, because I want to land on the tennis courts and ruin a tennis game.
Yeah, only if it's a Killzone 3 style jetpack.
Like that, was it like the Riddick Bowe Holyfield fight with the fan man? You remember that?
Yes, yes. Can I land on top of the Segway tours?
Okay, next question, James.
Kisaki Project writes, as we all know, Zelda is getting a little stale. I was thinking Nintendo should make the next one more open world like the original game, and you can do the dungeons in any order. Plus, depending on what order you do the dungeons, changes the puzzles because you'll have different key items based on your progress. This would add replay value and take some of the good concepts from Western RPGs. Also, have lots of people and stuff to do like in Majora's Mask.
Well, it's nice to want things.
That would make the puzzles very hard to design if you have to make them essentially assaultable from various angles.
It's kind of nice to think what the possibilities could be in that sense, and like, you know, where people would play the game and then talk to their friends about it and have quite different experiences and stuff. But the problem is that it, without like an army of designers or whatever, it might be very, very difficult to actually create puzzles of comparable complexity and intricacy that have that many different ways to attack them. Too many variables.
What I love about this email is that it made me think about the original Legend of Zelda in a different way, because I love the idea that the original Zelda game is an open world game. Mm-hmm. I'd never thought about it in that way before, and I think you can make that argument. I mean, they do kind of just throw you in there with no direction at all, and you can complete a lot of the dungeons out of order, but part of the reason, I mean, I do love the idea that you can go anywhere, and I think some of the recent Zelda games, especially Twilight Princess, has a problem with walling you off from certain areas.
Yeah, it's pretty much on rails, at least story-wise.
It's too directed. Yeah. You know? I mean, they should let you loose a little bit, let you get lost, let you have to find the next thing.
I mean, you could at least do it in an Ocarina of Time. There's the Shadow of the Spirit that you could do in either order. I mean, you could, you know, you could have like pairs or, you know, little clusters of dungeons that don't have to be done in a specific order.
Right. But the reason that the original Zelda game got away with that is that the dungeons didn't actually have puzzles in them. I mean, they weren't item-based puzzles like you now associate.
They just were. I mean, they just basically went around and killed things.
They had a lot of combat, and there were, you know, you could definitely get into a dungeon that was over your head, mm-hmm. but there's actually very few places in the game where you have to have the raft to get to, or you have to have the ladder to get through this one room in Dungeon 6 or whatever it is.
Yep.
That is extremely rare. So for the most part, you can do the levels out of order, but that's because they're really unstructured.
Yeah.
Those original Zelda dungeons are not really Zelda dungeons by today's standards.
It's a link to the past is what we're really talking about, where we get to, you know, the template that has been, you know, furthered and taken into 3D and so forth. And I think there was some flexibility in the Dark World and stuff, because you didn't have to do, they were numbered, but you didn't have to do them in the numbered order strictly. Again, similar to Shadow and Spirit, a bit of flexibility. But yeah, I mean, given my aversion to open world games and Western RPGs, I would live in fear of the Zelda getting more like them. I like them the way they are for the most part.
I think there are things that Zelda could learn from Western RPGs, but I wouldn't want it to become one.
I mean, I look at the uproar with Dragon Quest IX when they tried to redesign that. I mean, they wound up scrapping everything and saying, okay, well, we don't want a riot, so we're just going to go back to the way it was before.
How great a grounds for a riot would that be?
Well, John, also remember Dragon Quest VIII was at that time one of the highest selling games in the history of Japan.
Very true.
The Zelda Twilight Princess does not have that problem.
No, it doesn't. That's true. But I mean, I think the thing is, by any anxiety I would have is very much tempered by the fact I don't think, you know, Nintendo in any danger of doing any such thing. But I think if, you know, if they make good on the promise to break down the very, at this point, predictable barrier between dungeons and overworld elements and just kind of blur the line and bring them together, make it feel more organic, that would be enough of a substantive change to me.
And that actually would be very Western RPG. That's one of the things Western RPGs do, is that they don't necessarily have these discrete dungeons that you go into. Mm-hmm. They have this overworld and things happen on it, and it's not always clear what is a story critical thing. They also have all these side quests, you know, and I mean, I think there's some good ideas in there. I would love the Majora's Mask thing, though. I mean, I love that game, but you have to design the entire game around that mechanic.
I love that game more than I love Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, me too.
And it's not close.
I don't think Nintendo's ever going to make another Majora's Mask, because that is, you have to start from the beginning. You have to make that clockwork design where all the characters are in a certain place on a certain day. You have to start that from scratch. The game has to be about that. It's not a feature you can tack on at the end.
Yeah, and I think you would also have to have the same thing where they would want to quickly reuse an engine.
Yeah, that's what it was born out of, yeah. Was the restrictive, just like, hey, you know, we put a lot of time and money into Ocarina. It was very successful, so we definitely got capacity to spend more money off from it, but, you know, we don't want to spend that much time doing it. And it was quick. I mean, you know, it came out in April of 2000 in Japan. They turned it around quick, but they made the most of the limitations that they put themselves on with this ingenious conceit for the clockwork nature of everything.
Yeah, I think Skyward Sword is in such a completely different situation. I think they're better off actually throwing away everything they did in Twilight Princess and just starting from scratch, which seems to be what they're doing. So it's just a very different situation. Okay, Greg has the next letter.
Tales of Fan writes, my taste seems to be almost identical to James, and when I do pick up titles that he recommends, I tend to really enjoy them. Recently, I've just played through Ghost Trick, and I'm currently playing through 999. Are there any other games that James can recommend that are very similar to these, besides Phoenix Wright and Professor Layton, which are already in my backlog? They do not have to be visual novels, but rather games that have very well-written stories. Secondly, with the release of the Virtual Console on 3DS, do you think there is a possibility of Nintendo allowing for the transfer of Wii Virtual Console games, such as NES and Super NES titles, in the future? We can already see something similar with Sony and their allowing for the use of PS1 titles on both PS3 and PSP.
So, James, first question.
Oh, I mean, I'm trying to run through my head real quick.
Ogre Battle 64?
I think I gave a slobbering review of that last week, so we're in good shape.
In terms of very well-written stories, it does contain the line, you're a piece of shit, so I don't know.
That is...
Hey, it works for Killzone 2, buddy.
I don't know whether it qualifies or not.
That would actually be a good line from Killzone 2 from how you're selling it.
One of the better ones, yeah.
Yep.
You know, I spoke heavily multiple times about my feelings on Fragile Dreams, which I really enjoy, despite having terrible gameplay. I spoke reasonably well about the storytelling in...
Skycrawlers, because you're crazy.
I actually enjoyed that story a bit. I mean, there's stuff there that it's kind of, you have to assume on your own a little bit.
What about RPGs?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of RPGs either have really awful stories... And I think in the grand scheme of things, most RPGs have better stories than most games, but you're stuck with it for 30 hours. So if it's not really good...
It's more exposed.
If it's not really good, it's going to feel really bad. That's kind of where Eternal Sonata is, because it's got an interesting story, but after 23 hours, you're kind of like, all right, how is this the end of this story? And you just get mad at it. That's all I can think of right off the top of my head.
Have you ever played any other visual novels before 999?
Yeah, but I can't think of any of their names right now. They're all really obscure. I mean, you can really Google visual novels. You'll find lots of them that have fallen into freeware status or are maybe not licensed in this country and have been fan translated and stuff like that.
Radical Dreamers, the Chrono Trigger one.
Right,
is
and that's
like
a good example. That was a visual novel, and literally, I mean...
Well, it's more the Chrono Cross one, actually. It's like Proto Cross, if you like.
Right, it's somewhere between the two. But I mean, that's not really even all that visual. That's more novel. I'm trying to think what else I spoke of recently. I spoke of Sakura Wars back at the early part of the year.
Last year,
yeah.
Now, about virtual console transfers, I think that this is actually a possibility, believe it or not, but I think it's a possibility for transferring from the Wii to Nintendo's next console, not from the Wii to the 3DS.
I think they're going to be parallel.
Yeah, I think Nintendo's going to keep it pretty well partitioned between console games on your console and portable games on your portable. And it makes good business sense. It's also easier for people to understand. And it makes it so that you're not necessarily wanting to transfer your purchases or feel like you have to repurchase things so often. Because the console and the handhelds tend to be more staggered, and
we've already seen the suggestion of Super NES games getting some sort of 3D update that, you know, might be 3DS ware release of Yoshi's Island or something like that, but not just, hey, you know, you've already paid for Yoshi's Island on your Wii, so here's a remote play style thing to play it on 3DS. That will not happen.
I mean, the whole remote play thing. I mean, how many people actually do that? I mean, the only game I've ever done that with was Symphony of the Night, and it was more just kind of a like novelty sort of, hey, let's see if I can do this and let's see how it runs. It's a cool idea, but I just think it's highly overrated.
Prime example, Ogre Battle 64. If I could play that on the go because I bought it on my Wii, I would have played it a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
Not that many of my virtual console games kind of fall into that category, but yeah, I could play Super Metroid on my DS because I bought it on my Wii. And so, I mean, I'd love it. I would love it.
If I could play Tecmo Bowl on the go, I could beat the entire game in one meeting I'm not paying attention to.
Yeah, and if you look at how nitpicky Nintendo is about their virtual console emulation, they would have to be able to write parallel emulators for every game that would work on both systems, and they're not going to do that.
Yeah, especially considering virtual console, you know, predates all that, you know, 3DS, obviously, by many years. It's not happening.
No.
But, you know, I mean, I personally see the utility in it.
I mean, yeah, like you said, if I would love to play Ogre Battle on a 3DS. Now, of course, if they'd put out a retail release, I'd pay $80 for it again or whatever. But still, I mean, there's a lot of games that I would like to be able to play on the go. Maybe because I feel like they're better suited to that than what they're currently formatted for.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think in Japan now, it's getting to be quite a thing. Because for a long time, the Japanese PSN had a lot more games, retro stuff, than the other regions, you know, North America and Europe, but it wasn't that much stuff. But now there's a lot of PS1 stuff coming out and even PC Engine stuff as well. You know, and I think a lot of it has to do with remote play and the fact that, you know, the PSP has got popular as well. I think the rise of the two things kind of goes together. So, I mean, certainly, you know, there is a demand for this sort of thing.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look back through the last 5 years of Wii and DS coexisting, Nintendo's had so many possibilities for, you know, making them work together and do interesting things together that they've just left on the table.
They've passed on most opportunities. You know, when you have DS demos through the Nintendo channel and, you know, a few things here
and
there.
And some of that was just because it was stuff that the DS couldn't do. I mean, the DS didn't have a built-in browser, so it couldn't download its own demos. So they're like, okay, we'll let you download them on the Wii and then send them to your DS. That's a workaround. Yeah. That's not really using the capabilities of each system together.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like something they'd want to do. They'd want to be able to buy SNES games again on your 3DS.
Added value.
Yeah.
That's right.
A premium 3DSware thing.
Yeah, they use that word premium too or something along the line.
Yeah, the whole pricing on the eShop is still completely unknown and it's
frightening.
Be very, very interesting. What do you charge for a black and white Game Boy game? I mean, that's going to be very interesting. And once GBA stuff comes out, I mean, are GBA games $10? $10-$12? Probably.
I mean, the other thing is comparing it with PSN. Of course, PSN has, you know, more of a variable pricing system. Like most of them are, you know, 600 yen, for instance, in Japan. But stuff like Final Fantasy Tactics would be 1,000. Final Fantasy 7 would be 1,500. You know, they vary it up. And even Japan's virtual console has an RPG premium, which you get. Or it sometimes goes outside of RPGs, like stuff like Zelda games as well. So could you have a variable pricing model this time for, you know, the virtual console, so that, you know, maybe something like Zelda Link's Awakening DX is more than Mario Land?
Just possible. I think going to the cash-based system and getting away from Nintendo points makes it easier for them to do variable pricing.
I'm going to miss having to translate press releases to money and Nintendo points.
Well, you can still do it on the Wii for a good while, I'm sure.
Yeah.
John has the next letter.
All right. Buttle writes, first, a big thanks to Greg for editing. Why are you the only podcast editor who I know of that puts in different tracks? Second, I've played both the new Play Control and the original for Jungle Beat, and although I agree with everything you said about the original, it really does start to hurt my hands, wrist, and head after a while. With new Play Control, it's a calming, relaxing experience, which I really appreciated. Third, lately I was able to enjoy an evening of Super Meat Boy with a 360 friend. Within my first hour of playing, I was able to beat most of the difficult levels that had frustrated him for weeks. I tried to brag to my wife, but she was unimpressed, telling me that I should be good at it since I've been playing that basic game my whole life. Last, I finally beat Fluidity last night, and it was, of course, an excellent title, but oh man, did I get tired of the jumping mechanic. My biggest complaint about the Wii is that so many games have one non-optional motion control that puts a black spot on the game. It makes me not sure what I want in Nintendo's next console. Whatever they do, I'll admit, I'm a little worried. It seems like a difficult switch to go from the Wii to what's next for the Big N.
Okay, so from the top, Greg, you want to explain a little bit about the chapters that you
We've covered the chapters before. I do it because it's always been done.
Right.
It goes back to Mike's Glenn's podcast co-founder's Apple supremacist streak or whatever that he wanted to put chapters in because he could, and we've just kept up the practice. I assume the reason why a lot of other people don't do it, because a lot of podcasts, they record in the same room, so there's nowhere near the level of production that goes into this one, and so they probably just they record it as a file, put a bumper on it at the beginning and end, and that's they spit it out. That's it. Done. This takes several hours to produce, so putting some chapters in at the end is relatively trivial, I mean, compared to all the other work that goes into it.
And it seems highly appreciated.
Yeah, apparently it is. It's certainly the appreciation to hours put into it ratio is bloody good. So I guess I will continue to do it.
Yeah, and the other thing is those tracks are only supported in the AAC file format.
Yeah.
Which, if you've downloaded this through iTunes, that's what you're getting. But we also provide an MP3 feed that some people use for whatever reason. Maybe they...
That's what I use because it's what my MP3 player supports.
Yeah, and not everything supports AAC. So
it's old.
And so we give that option, whereas MP3 is almost universally supported except for on the DSi.
It will be supported on the 3DS, though, so we're okay.
Yeah, it's back. MP3's back.
MP3's back, baby!
They're going premium with this one.
We'll pay that dollar.
Most people who... do a podcast and they do it sort of quick and dirty, we'll only do MP3 because that's the most universal format.
Well, and the other issue being that it's hard to do the chapters if you don't have a Mac.
Yeah. To the next part about Jungle Beat, Jungle Beat is a game that you can't play it for 12 hours. I mean, it's a physical game. You can't play, it's like a Wii game. You can't play any Wii game for 12 hours if it has any kind of motion control or even pointing control. I wouldn't want to play Metroid Prime 3.
What was that? Sorry.
I wouldn't want to play Metroid Prime 3 for 12 hours. I'd be exhausted. So, it's okay to break it up into pieces, and the game, the levels are fairly short, so it's easy to do that. The other thing, though, is don't bang on the bongos. I mean,
no.
Honestly, you don't need to. You can tap it pretty lightly with your fingers.
Doesn't that sort of take away some of the dramatic flair of it? I mean...
I guess.
It does, but when you're trying to get, like, platinum medals or whatever, you don't give a shit about dramatic flair. You just want it to be reliable and not kill your wrist.
It's one of those things where if you're playing at a high level, like any sport, watch a person playing a musical instrument, watch a drummer and see how hard he hits the drums. He hits it just as hard as he needs to get the sound that he wants. And that's essentially what it's like playing Jungle Beat with the bongos. You end up, over time, I think you develop methods to use the minimal effort to get the effect that you want. And a lot of people do that on Wii games too. I mean, that's where Waggle came from. You're supposed to make this big sweeping motion, but then people realize, oh, I can just shake it. And then eventually developers just decided to replace the word move your arm up and down or whatever with shake the remote. And now, so literally it tells you shake the remote because they know that's what you're going to do anyway.
Yep.
It still makes a little bit of a sound, which I think is the important part. Even if you're tapping it lightly with your fingers, you can still hear it, and that's the whole point. So, it's okay. If your hands hurt from playing Jungle Beat, I'm not saying you're doing it wrong, but you could do it better. There's a way to play it that it won't do that.
Don't hurt yourself, kids.
Yeah, really. Super Meat Boy thing was funny. Fluidity. So... this is something I maybe haven't talked about, but the way you jump in Fluidity, which it's a weird concept that you would jump considering you're controlling a pool of water that might be in multiple places at the same time.
It really does kind of throw the Bionic Commando thing into stark relief, doesn't it? This man, this biped can't jump,
yes,
but this puddle of water can.
It's because his arm is so heavy. But yeah, so you can jump, and it makes sense in the world because basically you're controlling the storybook that the game takes place in. You're controlling the level. You're tilting the level back and forth. So when you jump, you're basically shaking the level.
Yeah.
And that causes the water to bounce up, and you do it by jerking the remote. You shake the remote basically. But the reason they do that, I totally support the decision. It doesn't bother me at all. I rarely have an issue with it. It's not 100% perfect. I'd say it's 99% perfect. And the reason they do that is because it doesn't require a button. Because you play this game NES style, so you have two usable buttons, number one and number two. And there are many abilities in the game, and they've mapped it very cleverly so that you can do all these abilities with only two buttons. And the alternative to shaking it, to using motion control for jump, is you could use the big A button, which is not good, or you can use the B button on the underneath, which is even worse.
Well, but I mean, this begs the question, you know, classic controller, it has more buttons.
No, but the game is tilt-controlled. The game really only makes sense with tilt control. I mean, I guess you could program it to work with a joystick, but it just wouldn't be the same at all.
Because, say, for instance, and yeah, it moves, has like a full range of control options in terms of, like, I played it with the simplest one with the NES style, and you just tilt the controller to rotate the world, you know, as you, mm-hmm. you know, would think intuitively, but they still had classic controller in there.
Yeah, sure. I think Fluidity is a rare game that actually wouldn't feel very good with classic controller. You know, obviously I haven't tried it because I can't, so I can't say that for sure, but I feel like this is a game where motion control, tilting the remote back and forth, number one, makes the most sense, and number two, it works really, really well. So that's why I have no complaint about it, is that it's probably the best tilt control of any Wii game that I've played, any. So I'm totally fine with it. And the jumping, I'm totally fine with because it works. So if you don't like it on principle, I can't help you. But it does work extremely well, and so I'm totally fine with it. As to whether you're worried about Nintendo's next console, man, we don't know what the hell's going on with that.
Yeah, I think everyone agrees it's just going to be a very hard act to follow, Wii. And you know, what road do you take at that point? You know, is there another paradigm shift to be had? I mean, you know, supposedly they've been burning through all this R&D cash, and unless someone there is actually Batman, surely somewhere it's going to show fruit at some point.
That would be kind of cool, actually.
Not Batman, but Lucius Fox. That's who you need.
Yeah.
The guy inventing stuff for Batman.
Exactly.
Q. You need a Q or an R.
Yeah, I mean, they may not even know themselves, really, what they're going to do with the next console at this point. I mean, it's pretty obvious they're focusing entirely on the 3DS right now. And Iwata says that it's not the end of the line for consoles, but...
Where do you take it, is the question. And, you know, where do you take it in Japan, where the portables are just encroaching more and more and more on the console space?
I mean, it used to be every 5 years, you're getting another console no matter what.
I think it comes down to the next console will have to have some kind of strategy for dealing with the encroachment of the handheld space, of which they are greatly responsible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They basically have two divisions now that are going to have to go at each other a little bit. And that might be good for them.
I mean, look, what they've done with the Wii stuff, as much as anything, is make it about what can you do with people gathered around the same TV.
Right.
Just really makes it special.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what's the technological leap that takes you in that direction? Well, Kinect is a pretty big one there, mm-hmm. to be fair to it, I think.
But doesn't make sense in Japan.
It doesn't make sense in Japan. So what transcends Kinect that's Japan friendly but's gonna have appeal everywhere else? This is why they're spending an awful lot of money to find that answer, provided that they're not vigilantes.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that Nintendo's next console will just be a cheap karaoke machine. So you get everybody together in front of the TV in small rooms in Japan.
It's going to be endorsed by Rick Astley. It's going to be awesome.
Oh, yeah. All right. Next letter. I think this will have to be our final letter this week. We'll try to catch up again soon. Plugabugs writes, in your Game of the Year awards, you didn't mention your biggest almighty fuck-up of 2010 in gaming. Are there any that deserve that coveted accolade?
Oh.
I have one in mind, but I want to see what you guys say.
Hmm.
I've got two from the same publisher, actually.
Nice. Is this Laser Tag?
No.
Ubisoft rewarded us with fuck-ups this year. I mean, that whole press conference was kind of a
fuck-up.
Well,
I mean, I think Red Steel 2 was a fuck-up in terms of marketing.
I think it was in terms of undelivered potential, too.
To some extent. I think the game, you know, gameplay-wise is largely successful. It shouldn't have been called Red Steel 2. I think that did a lot more harm than good. But, okay, here's my two. Number one, Tony Hawk, Shred.
Oh, Jesus.
Is that what it was called? I mean,
why does that game exist?
Clearly they fucked up the year before with whatever the thing was called with the skateboard.
Right.
They had a chance to abandon that or else actually fix it, and instead they basically released the
Once
same
game. Once
more
into the breach.
Yeah, they basically released the same game, but now you're not snowboarding either. and the game did horribly. I mean, they didn't know how to market it. They, you know, they're trying to sell kids this like $120 toy that's not fun. They really should have learned their lesson the first time.
And the realization is you could look at it. You could look at it at E3-09 and go, that doesn't look fun.
I thought it was a really interesting idea, but the actual implementation of it was very poor.
So can I guess what your next Activision fuck-up was?
Yeah, Guitar Hero.
Yeah, Guitar Hero. Or just blank Hero at this point.
Yeah, well, not even existing anymore now.
Yeah.
That is the ultimate fuck-up.
Yeah, so Guitar Hero, they took the most popular thing in gaming and drove it into the ground, which, you know, again, that's the same thing they did with Tony Hawk. They did it in even less time with Guitar Hero.
Because they were making like 2 to 3 a year. I mean,
yeah, in the span of 6 years, they completely obliterated that franchise. They made everybody fucking sick. They kind of ruined Rock Band 2, I think. Although,
it's like Warriors of Rock, guys. This will be great.
Yeah, Guitar Hero 6 Warriors of Rock.
You turn into monsters. No!
It's a fucking mess. I mean, it's a fucking mess. I saw that demo at E3 and I thought, what are you guys thinking? I mean, there are like 50,000 dudes who are on scorehero.com who are going to love this because now their scores can go. I mean, that game, as Greg famously said, that game goes to 11. I mean, it's arbitrary score multipliers do not make your game better, much less different than the one before. And the whole attitude, the whole style of that game is so misinformed. It's so misdirected. I get that they don't want to just do the same thing as Harmonix. Like, I get that they respect what Rock Band was doing enough to not say, hey, maybe we should... Well, they'd already tried that with, like, Band Hero and yes. Shit like that. So they'd already tried that. It hadn't really worked out. So they're like, you know what? We're just going to go in a completely different direction. This was not the correct, completely different direction to go in. Okay? I can't tell you what the right thing to do with Guitar Hero would probably take a year off. That probably would have been the smart thing.
How about not make Guitar Hero Aerosmith Edition?
Yeah, oh, I mean, that was a huge mistake up
front. What was the one they were basically giving away?
Van Halen.
Van Halen, which I have. I played it once. I have it. I mean, the thing is, you can't give that game away. It was already given away to me. So it's not like I can sell it on eBay. It's not worth jack shit.
If you're giving away versions of your game, that's a sign you need to stop.
Again, and they should have learned that lesson in 2009. Instead, they made it even worse in 2010.
It is incredible when you have something that could be likened to a speculative bubble in the markets involving one entity. You know?
It is kind of like that.
Everyone's kind of betting on things going up and up and up because everyone else is, but here it's just like, yeah, let's bet on having 4 Guitar Hero SKUs in a single year because... we can.
This will work.
It's absolutely crazy, the escalation that it got to.
Well, and the thing is, the craftsmanship in these games hasn't really gone down. It's not like Warriors of Rock is a bad game. The problem is, it's not different in any material way than all the other Guitar Hero games, of which there are very many, okay? Yep. So, the problem is, the Bobby Kotick style of thinking, it's like, we're making a lot of money on this, let's do it again. There's no creativity whatsoever put into the design of that product. And that's the problem. It's not that it's badly made. It's that it's just made. That's all they did is make it.
It's the Activision way.
It is. And I mean, you see that, you know, it hits sometimes and it misses others. I mean, you know, look at Call of Duty, you know, even though you have the whole off-year Call of Duty thing, they put a lot of money behind Black Ops in terms of promotion.
Right.
And it did damn well considering it's, you know, the lesser Call of Duty, even though the Infinity War doesn't exist anymore, but, you know, relative to the
actually,
way,
do
way
exist,
it does, but it's been
gutted.
Which is that's a fuck up in itself.
Sure.
Can we just give it to Activision and be like, everything?
Activision had a bad year.
They really, really did.
Yeah, I suppose most people would probably say that whole thing was probably the Zampella and West thing.
And that lawsuit's just embarrassing. It's embarrassing for all parties. It's embarrassing. I mean, it's horrible.
It's
embarrassing for THQ, who wasn't even involved, who's been named. I mean, it's horrible. And then to go back to Johnny's point of trying to just monetize out the Guitar Hero franchise, they went and made DJ Hero, which wasn't eminently successful, and said, we need to make another one right now.
I would say, you know, along the same lines, I think a fuck-up as well was Green Day Rock Band.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Oh, Harmonix is not exempt from this.
No, they're...
That game
guilty
bombed.
Too,
huge.
But I mean, they're not quite as guilty.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just the whole thing is really strange to me. I think the whole music thing got way too big, way too quickly, and the people managing it got gold in their eyes and didn't think with their heads, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a bubble. There's two players in it, really, with harmonics as well, but, you know, it wasn't as bad.
Right, I mean...
But I guess maybe the first sign that it was not just going to go up and up and up was Beatles Rock Band's Soft Landing.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, which is, that's heartbreaking. That game is magnificent.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons to think that would do extremely well, that it would, you know, cross over, you know, into a mainstream kind of appeal that the other games maybe didn't quite have. They certainly had some, but this would exceed that and expand it, while appealing to, you know, people like Johnny as well, who've played plenty of those games before, but it didn't happen on the kind of scale that you thought it might do, and, you know, that was really kind of the first sign that it was going all downhill from there.
See, I kind of go back to when the split happened, and they couldn't even agree on guitar standards. It's like, guys, how important do you think you are that you get to drive the guitar standards for plastic fucking instruments?
Yeah.
Well, actually, on that point, James, I have to say, and we got to wrap this up, but the keystone of this fuck-up is the moment, for me, when I realized just how bad this was going to be, is when I sat in that same E3 demo for Warriors of Rock, and I saw the guys bring out their new guitar for 2010.
Oh, yeah.
And they're showing how it's basically just the bass, and it has, like, modular necks and wings, and you can attach different things. And I thought, why? Why are you spending money to develop and distribute another fucking plastic guitar when you know the people who want to buy Guitar Hero Warriors of Rock already have six of them? Why would you?
It really
do
comes
this?
Down to greed. They discovered that they could make a shit ton of money off of selling plastic
instruments.
If you're
going to release a game every year, you could not release a plastic guitar iteration every year.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you go to GameStop now, you'll see like 80 of the fucking things up on racks.
Oh, they're giving them away.
Just like take one, please.
Yeah, they're giving them away.
I didn't buy a guitar game. I know, just take one.
Yeah, they're all going into landfill. Now it's like they're going to have like Landfill Rock Band next. That's going to be the next iteration.
It's incredible hubris. Incredible.
It's not just Guitar Hero, though. I mean, it's Activision as a whole.
Their business model is...
Turn and burn.
Yeah. I mean,
that's what it is.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
And then as long as they can find the next thing, it'll work.
Hey, I don't begrudge Activision their success, because I mean, on the whole, they're obviously very successful, and the thing is, they're so successful with things like Call of Duty and Blizzard that they can afford these epic fuck-ups in their other divisions. But it's so unnecessary. They have these good series that they are destroying. I mean, creatively, it's heartbreaking. From a business sense, I'd still buy Activision stock if I could. If I had the money, I'd buy it. But, geez, I mean, just as a gamer, it's pathetic what they're doing to all their other franchises. It's sad. All right, well, I think we can all agree that was a pretty massive fuck-up in 2010. So
I guess on a much smaller scale, 50 hertz on a disc for Super Mario All-Stars.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently not, because they could have sold that for $90.
Well, I don't know what it's going for over here, but more than it should be. I think
the fuck-up was they didn't charge enough for it, apparently.
Yeah, that's what Reggie and Shibata and everyone else have been saying, yeah.
All right, guys. Well, despite the lightning round format, we still went longer than I wanted to, and we didn't get to all the letters I had picked out, so we'll save those. We'll get back to them very soon. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. The email address, once again, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please send us a letter. If you've ever thought about it, just sit down and do it. You'll be glad you did. We would love to hear from you. All right. To wrap up the show, PAX East is a month away, less than a month by the time you hear this. We're very excited. It looks like Greg won't be joining us, unfortunately. We really wish he was, but we do have a huge contingent of NWR staff members going to be there, and we've got all kinds of stuff planned, and we're still working on our plans for it, so we're very excited. We hope you'll come out. You can link up to us on Facebook. We have over 200 followers. I'd like to get to 250 by PAX. We'll see if that See if that happens. It's totally doable, though. iTunes, if you've never gone over there and rated and reviewed us, we really would appreciate that. And of course, next week we'll be coming back to you with Retroactive, the wrap-up on Ogre Battle 64. So if you've been playing along or if you've even just barely tested it out, leave your thoughts in the forum thread, and we'll be picking those out to discuss on the show next week. With that, we're done. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, I mean, what other franchises do they have?
They got the Bond license.
They're running out.
That's right. They got the Bond license, and they put out two DS Bond games within like a month of each other.
Mm-hmm. No, that was like the same week, dude.
Was it really?
There's going to be another Bond game this year as well, isn't there? Even though the film still won't be ready.
That's right. There's going to be a game.
They're already going to be cranking out more Bonds. So
it's the Tomorrow Never Dies remake.
Jonathan Pryce.
Look forward to that. And we have an in-depth preview of Radiata Historia, the new Japanese RPG.
Radiant, isn't it?
It's Radiant.
Radiant? Oh, I thought it was Radiata.
Radiant Historia.
It's from the guys who made the Radiata.
Radiata?
Sorry.
How is he involved in this?
All right. We also have an in-depth preview of Radiata. It's on the page. Here,
let me clap.
Let me change it on my notepad.
Don't clap, John.
I won't do that again.
Don't clap, John.